The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is still met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. So today I have been asked to talk about Achalanatta Bodhisattva. I feel we are already permeated with his teaching after that wonderful ceremony. So I am going to just point out a few things and talk a little bit about some of my own experiences with Achalanatta. And well, let's just see. So, I have recently been reflecting on, given the gravity of so many situations in the world, the environment, the economy, military clashes all over the world, and really a great deal of suffering. What is the Buddhist teaching that we can bring that will help both ourselves and others? What is the heart of our practice, and what is it that we can do really to deal with our own suffering in the face of these difficult situations and to help others do the same? And I think Achalanatta offers us that very image of what it is that we can do. There he is in his shrine. He is sitting amidst the flames of greed, anger, and delusion. And this is what we see often, is it not? Turn on the TV and there we are looking at it. This is what we can experience within our own daily lives, within our own responses to situations. So what he is doing is sitting still. He is sitting still, and he is called the Lord of Light. He is one of the fierce Lords of Light. He's fierce because he needs to be, does he not? When you think about it, he has a lot. He has a lot to deal with, and he is showing us what it is that we can do. He is, at the same time, he is an emanation and a form. He's an emanation of Vairochana Buddha, and he is a form of Avalokiteshvara. He is another form of compassion. He is here showing us in this fierce way, really pointing us to the heart of compassion. If we have not been able to see it or understand it or respond to it in this gentle form, he can show it to us in another way. This is one of the things really that I have always appreciated about Buddhism, is that the truth manifests in so many different ways. One of our offertories says the Buddha appears in any form that will help beings. And sometimes it's one form, sometimes it's another. But we don't need to worry too much or get too confused about which form it is, whatever helps, if there is something that we can learn. His seriousness, his determination, his resolve is really conveys to us the seriousness of our encounter with our own suffering and with our own koan. He takes it seriously. He takes it very seriously. And he is reminding us not to fool around, you know. Um, I think sometimes we are surprised when people take us seriously, are we not? People can remember what we have said or reflect back to us something that we have said or told us something that shed some light on their difficulty or suffering. And sometimes if we remember it and take it seriously, I find that people are sometimes surprised, you know. But actually, this is a serious business. That doesn't mean that there is not some humor to it. There is a lovely story about Avalokiteshvara and how Achalanata came into being. The story is that Avalokiteshvara made a vow to save all beings. And he said that if he broke his vow, he or she, however you want to think of him or her, because of course, as we know, he's depicted in both genders, but if he broke his vow, his body would shatter into 1,000 pieces. So one day he was looking out at the world and he saw as much suffering as he had seen when he started out. This was eons later, after helping people with gentle, loving kindness for eons. And he saw as much suffering as he had seen originally. And it made him think that he had broken his vow. And his body shattered into 1,000 pieces. And Amida Buddha put him back together. And each one of those 1,000 pieces became one of his arms. So, you know, you see those 1,000 armed kanzeons. So an arm, and in the palm of each hand, there was an eye. So that he now had eyes to see everywhere and 1,000 arms to help. And out of his heart sprang Achalanata. And Achalanata was there to help where gentle loving kindness did not. So Achalanata is simply another aspect of kanzeon for those who need a more direct approach. Now actually I've been interested in when I have given tours to people and we come to the Buddha Hall and they have had no previous experience with Buddhism, ask me about Achalanata. And when I say, well, there he is, you know, in Buddhism, we believe that we create our own hells by our own passions of greed and hatred and delusion. And that is Buddhist view of hell, and he has taken a vow to remain still in hell and to show beings how to deal with their suffering. I'm amazed at how many people say, oh yeah. You know, there seems to be some kind of understanding and response to that image of just being able to sit still in whatever it is that we find painful or difficult, you know. Something about it seems to be, it's a very kind of enlivening and inspiring image. So I want to just tell about my first experience with Achalanata, not very dramatic, but very profound, actually. And this came to mind as I was thinking back. You know, it's always an interesting thing to think back in our lives and look at those little seeds that were planted, something that kind of turned us in the direction of finding the Dharma. I was in one of the helping professions, and I was working in a hospital in San Francisco, and the administration was making cuts in the hospital. We were having an administration, administrative meeting about the cuts in the hospital. It was really quite painful, and the staff was very distressed about what this was going to mean for the patients, and everybody was very heatedly, you know, giving their opinions, and I never hang back in those situations, so I was kind of flailing around, you know, and giving some very strong ideas, and I remember being very angry and upset. I happened to look down, this was a long table, I happened to look down the table and I saw one of my coworkers. He was sitting right across from me at the end of this table and he wasn't saying a word. He was totally, totally still. He was completely still. He was not feeding the fires and he just seemed perfectly at ease. And I thought to myself, how is it possible to sit still in the midst of all this, you know? I mean, how can he just sit there and not say anything? And then I thought, isn't that freedom, you know? Isn't that something? And I was so taken with it that something just stayed in the back of my mind. You know, I hadn't bumped into Buddhism yet, but there was this image of simply being able to sit still in the midst of suffering and, you know, all the passions being let loose. So I thought to myself, you know, there's another way. And but since I didn't know what it was at that time, I thought, well, let's see if I can take a step towards something. So I thought, you know, the first thing I need to do is to be able to sit still during the next meeting. I'd sit still and keep my mouth closed. And, you know, thinking back on that, I realized that actually there was, the conversion was already beginning to take place, even though I didn't have the, you know, I didn't understand really what was happening, but the impulse just to refrain, you know, and to not add anything. And then I thought, well, that's going to be hard. So I thought, well, maybe I need to do something with my hands. Why don't I crochet a blanket? I'll bring that into the next administrative meeting. And then I thought, well, that might be a little odd, bringing in a big blanket. It might call attention. Well, maybe, so I was just learning how to crochet, so I thought, well, I just bring something in, and I just brought in these little squares. And so I could just sit quietly and do something without having to add to this, to my own suffering and those that of those around me. So, you know, just it's interesting to look back on our journey to Buddhism and to just see the steps along the way, because so often I hear people say, well, gee, I could have done better than that. Why didn't I do something more? Why didn't I do something different? But in Buddhism, actually, no effort is wasted. You know, no effort is wasted. So, I think it's good not to look down on our seemingly very small efforts to practice, because, you know, that's what we knew how to do at the time. And when we found some, when we learned there was something more we could do, then we did that. But that experience, and isn't it wonderful, because, you know, whoever that person was doesn't have any idea. No, he's just living his life, and isn't that how it is? We have no idea the benefit and the merit and the help that we are giving others all the time. So, Alchalanata is manifesting in front of us all the time. If we don't expect to see him in that particular form, we'll see him all around us. Okay, so looking at some of what is going on in that iconography? He's sitting on a rock. He is grounding himself in his meditation. In his hand, he has a sword to cut through delusion. Now, in Buddhism, delusion is described in many different ways. Reverend Master Jiyu used to often talk about it as that which is unreal or hides us from the unborn. And she would say, you know, delusion is to ignore what is real. And she has a lovely little piece in Roar of the Tigress, Volume 2, where she says, have you ever thought about the word ignorance, to ignore? She says, we ignore what is really going on. We ignore the basic truth. We ignore the fact that the unborn exists. We ignore that there is karma and that one has to pay for that which happens. If you ignore what happens in the spring, you'll be surprised by the crop that turns up later. This is true on a very practical level, and it is true in our own lives. So this idea that delusion hides us from the unborn, you know, she would also say, don't make clouds in a clear sky. So in his other hand, Chalanatha is holding the rope of the precepts, signifying restraint and refraining. The first precept, cease from evil. When we cease from evil, good arises naturally, because that is what is naturally there. Evil is that which is, well, you know, that which causes suffering. It's not, in Buddhism, there is no idea of an inherent evil. Evil can turn up in any form, really, but it is that which causes suffering. So he's not holding that rope in order to rope us. We are choosing to restrain ourselves and to refrain from. Often we think there is something that we should be doing, but just as often it can be that there'd be better. There's really something we should not be doing, which is the other side of that. So it's always a good question to ask, because it's actually easier to refrain from doing something than it is to often to find something that is good or helpful to do. So the default position could be just to see what am I doing, and you know, is it good for me to continue doing this? So the invocations that we were singing today, I'd like to mention just something about invoking. When we have a ceremony for a bodhisattva, we are invoking their help through scriptures, through singing, through offertories, through making offerings on the altar. We are calling on their name. And often we can think we are calling on a power that is outside of ourselves. And it certainly is true that some people experience bodhisattvas in that way. It is also true that we have all of the attributes of the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas within us. Their purpose is really to point us within to what it is we already have. So when we are thinking of invoking a Chalanatha, we can think about calling forth the qualities that we already have within us of stillness, of resolve, of vigilance. These are all embodied in a Chalanatha. Now, I used to wonder why a lot of our offertories and scriptures would ask for help from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, because I thought, isn't that what they do naturally? You know, the essence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is that they are helping. So why is it that we need to ask them? Sometimes we ask them not to abandon us or to remember us or any number of ways of calling on them. I ran across this lovely little paragraph in a book called More to Dying Than Death by Lama Shenpen Hukum. And I think the way she puts this is really very helpful for us to be aware of. So she says, we are calling on these beings, and she calls them awakened beings. We are calling on these, it's not because awakened beings need persuasion to help us, but because until we recognize our need for help, we do not sufficiently open ourselves to it. It's as if all the awakened beings in the universe are hammering on our door trying to get in to help us, but we won't open up. We sit disgruntled behind our locked door, complaining that awakened beings never come to us, when all the time the key to opening the door lies in our hand. So, ain't it the truth? And the thing is, when we actually ask for help and open ourselves to it, we find that it is appearing everywhere. It's appearing everywhere in all different forms. As long as we don't have in mind some particular form, we will see that help is manifesting constantly around us. And that is the great compassion. That is the great compassion of the universe, of the Buddha nature, however you want to think about it. But there it is, and the Chalanatha is part of that. Every night here in the monastery, we invoke a Chalanatha's name. We do what we call the Chalanatha ceremony in this, starting in this shrine. It is a ceremony that we call the Heavenly Guardian Ceremony. And those of you who have stayed here have probably seen bits and pieces of it in various ways. We wait until after lights out. And then one of the seniors comes to the hall and offers incense and does bows in front of this altar as the beginning of that ceremony. Now, I just want to mention a few of the things that we were seeing today. In the invocation of a Chalanatha, hail to the mandala, let us so be engulfed within its praises evermore, that by our own wills and vigilance, may we our fetters cut away. May we within the temple of our own hearts dwell, amidst the myriad mountains. So we are talking about, by our own wills and vigilance, we are able to cut away our fetters. And we'll find out a little bit more about some of the fetters shortly here. May we within the temple of our own hearts dwell amidst the myriad mountains. We can think of the mountains in many ways. The mountains often refer to the self. So we can think about this in the midst of our koan, of our karma, the mountains. But within that, we can still remain within the temple of our own hearts. And we can do that peacefully and at ease. All right, then we were singing homage to all the deities of the Vajra rank. So we are talking about the wrathful deities of light. The light is what helps pierce the darkness of delusion. There's a lovely offertory that we sing that says, we pray that the light of the truth shall pierce the darkness of the streets of delusion. I think that's such a wonderful image. I don't know, it's really kind of compelling. I find myself walking down those streets really often, so I am grateful to have some light. And this light comes from the deities of light, of the Vajra rank. Destroy all evil totally, exterminate all defilements. Ham, mam. Now the exterminating the defilements has to do with our being able to see them through our wills and vigilance. Just see them straight on and let them go. They are purified by being able to see them and no longer holding on to them, not feeding them. We recognize them and we can offer them up. We don't have to kick them out. We do not turn away. We do not turn away. Now, in the next invocation, peace, peace, appeaser of enemies, conqueror of Mara. We'll talk about Mara shortly here. You who wear the garland of skulls, you resplendent one. So he is wearing the garland of skulls. There they are, you know. He's looking death straight in the face. Fearlessness. He is not turning away from it. You who look around are pure and immaculate and remove all stains. He looks everywhere. He doesn't turn away from anything. He is not afraid to look everywhere. You who look everywhere, who bind all evil and are yourself free from the fetters of Mara, you who are wholly pure, let all the devilish impediments vanish. So, after we recite these scriptures, which are part of the Achalanata ceremony, we go into the meditation hall, we offer incense in there, and we bless the hall and the monks who are sleeping in there. And what we are doing is asking for a peaceful night for ourselves and for the monastery and for the mandala, so that we can continue our training. Training goes on during the night. That's a whole other topic. Some of you are very familiar with what, but again, you know, this is part of, this is what we are doing here. We are addressing what can come up in the night for us and how we can train with it. So then the monk who's doing the heavenly guardian round goes around the whole monastery with a flashlight. Some of you may have seen a monk at night out with a flashlight. So the monk is going around the monastery, locking up everything and keeping everything safe, blessing the gates and asking that no disturbances come in so that everyone can have a peaceful night. And as we are walking, we are reciting a Dharani which invokes, it's called the Sambho Kojin Dharani, and it is the invokes the fierce protector of the three treasures. It's the Om Kembaya, Kembaya, Om Bata Soataka. So we have recited this in other ceremonies as well, but we are reciting this at night as we are walking around the temple. And we are dispelling fear. This is a Dharani that deals with fear, smashing, dispelling fear. Not evil, but fear, which is an interesting thing, is it not? And we can think about, you know, are the demons inside or out? What are we dealing with? What are we dealing with? One day my sister and I was just remembering this. We were looking at it through the telephone book, and we were looking in the yellow pages for something or other. She came across an ad for burglar alarms, and she said to me, "What?" She said, "You mean there are people out there who are afraid of real things?" So, as a monk once said, there's nothing out there to fear but parts of ourself that we have not yet accepted. And that is something I think we can reflect on. So talking a little bit about Mara, and it's interesting because Mara is mentioned in this only six lines of this one invocation. But Mara is mentioned twice. Now, we don't hear too much about Mara in our scriptures and invocations, but actually plays really a large part in our training when we kind of get to know him and can recognize when he turns up. He represents the doubts and the temptations that pull us out of our sitting place and get in the way. And he represents whatever we are attached to. So you can see he turns up in a variety of forms. He can turn up in any form. And we know that in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara let loose all his armies to try to pull the Buddha out of his sitting place. And he sent every kind of temptation, every kind of terror, every kind of wild animals, beautiful women, beasts, bad weather, soldiers, you know, just kind of threw everything at the Buddha. And the Buddha remained rooted in his meditation. Now, Mara continued to turn up in the life of the Buddha after his enlightenment, which is really very helpful for us to know, because it reminds us that no matter where we are in our training, we are still vulnerable to Mara. Reverend Master Jiu used to say, Mara turned up every morning at her breakfast table. And she used to just say, "Good morning, Mara." She said she always had a long-handled spoon if she was going to have breakfast with Mara, because she didn't want him to get too close. And that's part of course, how Mara works, isn't it? Once he turns up, then he wants to stay around. Mara turns up in any of these forms. So whenever Mara turned up, the Buddha always said in some form, "Mara, I see you. I see you. I know you, Mara." And this is the vigilance that is being talked about. That kind of vigilance, so that we can see those things that are distracting us and pulling us out of our sitting place. And in the stories of the Buddha's life, there are all kinds of wonderful exchanges with Mara, but I just want to share one with you because I think it's really helpful for all of us to then be able to transfer what is going on here to our own lives. So this is a little vignette from a book called Gotama Buddha by Hajime Nakamura. And it says, "Thus have I heard." And I'm going to paraphrase some of this because it's longer than I'm going to be reading. "The Venerable Master was once staying in Aruvala on the banks of the Niranjara River," that is the Buddha. "At that time, Mara, the evil one, had been following the Venerable Master for 7 years, seeking an unguarded moment." He was seeking an unguarded moment, but he was unable to find one. So then Mara, the evil one, drew near the venerable master, and having approached him, spoke to him in verse. So here is the Buddha meditating on the banks of the Narinjara River. And Mara says to him, "Are you so sunk in grief that you meditate in a wood? Or are you seeking to regain the wealth you have lost? Or have you committed some crime in the village? Why do you not associate with people? Are you friends with no one at all?" I mean, that sense of familiarity is really something. You know, this is how Mara, I mean, this is kind of an insinuating kind of thing. This is how Mara gets our attention. And you didn't even know you had a difficulty with this until Mara brings it up. I mean, that's what's so really interesting about this. It's so subtle. It's so subtle. Now, the Buddha, of course, has a lot more sense than we do, so he knew what to do about it. But I'm, you know, if you think about when I think about how I might respond, it's really interesting. So the Buddha says, "To completely uproot all grief, committing no sins, I meditate. With no grieving, all desire for existence I have cut away, and I meditate without stain, you companion of idlers." He calls Mara that. Sometimes he calls Mara cousin of the heedless, or cousin of the careless. So Mara, having heard what the Buddha said, he's discouraged. And it says, "Thereupon Mara, the evil one, before the venerable master, spoke the following verse, indicating his discouragement. A crow circles a stone the color of fat, thinking, will I find something soft here, something tasty? But finding nothing tasty, the crow flies away. Like that crow that approached the rock, we lose interest and take our leave of Gotama." So Mara goes off, having recited these verses indicating his discouragement, departs from that place and seated himself cross-legged on the ground, not far from the venerable master, silent, discouraged, with drooping shoulders, downcast, brooding, and unable to reply, scratching the earth with a stick. Isn't that an incredible image? When you think of how Mara can present himself so powerfully, the demons of Mara trying to unseat the Buddha. The Buddha says something to him, saying, "I see you, Mara." And Mara goes off, sits down, and scratches the earth with a stick. He's utterly dejected. I mean, actually, what it does is arouse compassion within us, doesn't it really? And we have compassion for our defilements and for those, our distractions and those things which are trying to pull us out of our seat of meditation. They are not evil. You know, they are not evil. They are, I mean, in a way, they're really asking us, are we serious about what we're doing? How serious are we? You know? So, it is really important that we cultivate the heart of compassion toward really toward our koan, right? This is just another way of looking at that. It's another way of looking at that. We are not trying to push it away. We are actually, we are embracing it and we are converting it. they are converting it. So I would like to end by sharing with you a story that, goodness, and I hope I have with me, I wonder. What? Maybe I don't. No, here it is. All right. It's a story that I think speaks for itself about the incredible power of meditation. I think perhaps I've told some of you this story some years back, but it seems good to tell it again in the context of this particular talk, looking at the power of sitting still and being immovable. Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story about when he was a young monk and befriended a French soldier in Vietnam during the war. He says, we sat down near the pump house and he told me about the visit he and five other soldiers had made 10 days earlier to Bao Quoc Temple. They went to the temple at 10 o'clock at night in search of Vietnamese resistors who were reportedly gathering at the temple. We were determined to find them, he said. We carried guns. The orders were to resist and even kill if necessary. But when we entered the temple, we were utterly shocked. What happened this time was so unexpected. Whenever we did searches in the past, people would run away or be thrown into a state of panic. When we entered the temple, he continued, it was like entering a deserted place. The oil lamps were turned very low. It was completely silent. We purposely stomped our feet loudly on the gravel, but there was no other sound. I had the feeling that there were many people in the temple, but it was completely quiet, apart from the ticking of a clock that was hanging nearby. The shouting of a comrade made me uneasy. No one made a reply. I pointed my flashlight into the empty room, and before our eyes appeared a solemn scene of 60 monks sitting still and silently in meditation. It was like we ran into a strange and invisible force. He said, it scared us so much that we turned and left the temple. The monks just ignored us. They didn't raise a voice in reply, and they didn't show any signs of panic or fear. He said, we ourselves were attracted to their calmness. It was worthy of our respect. We stood silently in the temple's courtyard at the foot of a large tree and waited for perhaps half an hour. There were a series of bells that sounded, and then the temple returned to normal activity. A monk lit a torch and came to invite us inside. But we simply told him why we were there and then asked to leave. He said, from that day on, I began to change my ideas about the Vietnamese people. So, I think we should never underestimate the power of meditation. It could save our lives. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha.